Yeah, my name is Jason Ford and currently reside in Southern California. Grew up in Washington State and got two kids. Was married for 18 years, so currently single and just trying to go on to find where my purpose is from here after the experiences I'll be talking about.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jason, for talking to me. There is a lot of talk about UFOs, and especially recently, as we talked about right before we started recording. So I think it's appropriate to have a conversation about this. We're gonna get into everything that happened to you. There's a lot. You like it seems like you had maybe like two or three lives from when I know about your story, and so I'm excited to talk about this. But I do want to start at the beginning, like I always do in these interviews. So, can you tell us a little bit about your parents? Give us some context, because usually that's where things are, especially as children. You know, we learn from our parents. So, how was faith in your family? What did your parents believe in? All that stuff.
Yeah, good question. So my mom was Roman Catholic and my dad was Southern Baptist. And I tell this story where when I was like 8 or 9 years old, I was kind of inquisitive and I was curious about religion. And so I approached my mom and I was asking her, what religion are we? And I think I kind of caught her off guard. And so she kind of went on a spiel like, well, I'm Roman Catholic, your dad's Southern Baptist, kind of mixes like oil and water. So essentially, the philosophy was kind of like the sense I got was we'll let you and your brother kind of handle that and come up with your own conclusion. So it wasn't just my family. And by the way, my parents are still married. I talk to them all the time. We've got a great relationship. And it wasn't just my parents. It seemed the community that I lived in was kind of a unique community because it was, if you've ever seen the movie Oppenheimer, Matt Damon's character heads up the Hanford site, which is one of the few sites that was responsible for the Manhattan Project, which was the development of the nuclear bomb. And so my dad was a nuclear engineer. My mom worked out at the Washington Power Supply System. So most of the people, it was a smaller high school. I went to Hanford High School, which was in Richland, Washington, which is southeast Washington, a place called the Tri-Cities, kind of right on the border of Oregon. And most of my peers were from all over the place. So I had friends that were German, Russian, Sweden, a real academic focused school, but a real scientific based community. And you had like Department of Energy up there and a lot of things that I remember asking like some of my buddies in high school, you'd be like, hey, what does your dad do? And the response almost always was like, he can't tell me. I don't know. He doesn't really talk about it. And he does say that there's things that go on that he can't talk about and essentially not to really even bring it up. So that was kind of the environment.
Was it because of like secret government project? Because if it was a regular nuclear power plant, I feel like people would be allowed to talk about it. But what do you think? Why were people not talking about what they did?
Yeah, there was a lot of I know that Battelle was up there. I don't know if that's still a company. There was some others that were doing like Department of Energy, I know. It's kind of notorious for a lot of secret stuff going on. And as I've gotten older, it's kind of interesting since I've come out even the last year or so telling this story, I've kind of, I don't believe in coincidences. I think everything happens for a reason. And I've reconnected with like guys I haven't talked to in like 35 years. And we've shared stories and I've told them, about what I was experiencing and everything. And we go back and forth and, hey, did you hear anything from your parents? And I've talked to now that, time has gone by, people are willing to talk about some things. And there's some pretty crazy stuff that almost sounds off the wall that may have been going on out there. So I don't think it's a surprise that areas like that have things maybe that are classified, you're not supposed to talk about, you need seek certain clearances to work out there. I knew that. Even my buddies that were getting jobs out of high school, you had to have certain clearances to get in to even work out at the plant, even if you were doing like construction or something. So that part didn't surprise me. Now, what that entails, I don't know. I thought it was just kind of interesting when I remember as I was going through this stuff, I had a really good buddy of mine that I've known for like, 30 years that I met in college that I'm still in touch with. And one of the things he said was like, man, maybe you're going through this stuff with craft and phenomenon and everything because of Hanford. And I never thought of it. And I thought, who knows, man? As I tell this story, I'm never going to claim that I know what all of this was. I can just talk on the experience and what was going on within that experience and how it was influencing me and essentially turned my life into a wreck. It was like reality turned upside down. So I don't know if Hanford had anything to do with it, quite honestly, but it's just interesting how some of these sightings on UFOs and things are over nuclear sites, especially missile ranges and things.
I've heard that before too, so I wonder. We didn't plan to talk about this, but I feel like I have to now. I'm interested.
Hey, go for it, man.
Do you mind sharing some of the things you said you heard, some of the things that possibly could have been going on? So we'll just say allegedly, but what do you think could have been going on? Because you said that and immediately my curiosity just peaked and I wanted to know more if you do know more.
I'll give you my take on it. And this is my humble opinion. Just at this stage, I'll be 52 next week. So I've lived kind of a Forrest Gump life, I guess, if you will, at this point, kind of a life that I never thought that I would live. And the things that go on behind the scenes, I think there's a lot more to it as far as the elite and everything else in control of this, and especially over these government institutions that I can't tell you what was going on. I'll give you one, which I heard that, for example, supposedly they were developing this is going to sound funny, but this is the type of stuff I'm talking about. Fish that they could genetically breed that were in the form of a triangle so that it was easy to cut them up like pizza and then ship them off as fish. So those types of things like genetic engineering, that stuff I'm almost positive was going on. There's even talk, if you want to go deep on it, where, once again, I don't think a coincidence. I had a buddy that had a podcast a few years ago, and he sent me his episode. He goes, hey, didn't you grow up at Hanford? I just had this guy on talking about all this crazy stuff that is these stories that go on in the legends out at Hanford. And so I watched it, and they're talking about as crazy as stuff as like, this goes down like the Columbia River Gorge and everything, which runs right along where I grew up. Columbia River is a large river, and going into Oregon and things, people would claim that they'd see like large black panthers roaming around, like in the middle of nowhere, and other entities that they couldn't explain. And so I guess the whole, if you want to go down the rabbit hole, was some of this genetic engineering could have led to, you know, hybrid animals and everything else that had maybe gotten loose. It sounds crazy, but after you hear my story, nothing really surprises me anymore. So
there's something that I like about what you said, because a lot of these sorts of stories, obviously, and you don't claim to know what happened, which I do appreciate with you, but a lot of people will either sensationalize stories or repeat sensationalized stories. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like genetic engineering to make it easier to ship out, like that is something I can absolutely believe. That makes a lot of sense. There's a goal behind it. Not that I don't believe other stories that sound more crazy. Like, that's the whole point of my channel. I do a lot of them, but not all of them, but this makes a lot of sense. And you talked about the Columbia River. I think that's I think that's what we had talked about. And I do actually want to talk about this, because there were some weird things happening maybe with the radiation in the area, and you were affected by that, or maybe affected by that. Do you mind talking about this, since we've been talking about everything nuclear that was going on in that region? What was going on with that?
Yeah, that was really strange. This was back in 2016, I believe. And I'll shorten the story, but essentially what had happened is I was at work and I was doing a presentation for clients. And one of the clients afterwards happened to be a doctor. And he came up to me afterwards, and he was really, and I was going through kind of that's when the darkness kind of started coming into my life, was like 2014, 15, and 16. I was having hardcore nightmares, the sleep paralysis and stuff I was talking about. The first time I shared this story, that was all part of it before the actual quote unquote phenomenon started with like lights and orbs and craft and everything. But this doctor had told me, hey, you know, we need you around. I need you to go to the doctor because I've been practicing for a long time and you have a vein. I think it was on this side. Hopefully it's not popping out here today, but there was a vein over here on this side, part of my head that was popping out. And I remember after he said that, I had recalled that a couple months earlier, one of my buddies had said the same thing. We were down at the beach and he goes, hey, that vein on the side of your head, you may want to go get that checked out. Maybe you have high blood pressure or something. So I go to the doctor, and this was a really strange experience because they took my blood pressure and it was astronomical. But when you have high blood pressure, a lot of times, or hypertension, it's just the norm. It's like the silent killer. So you feel normal. You don't feel all stressed out and anxious, but it was something ridiculous when they took it, you know, especially the lower number was like 130 or 135, but the high number was like 190 or something. So that's like strokeout material, right? But the doctor, when he came in and sat down with my wife and I, he was almost in a panic, and he was going through all of the EKG that they had done. And he was a nervous wreck, and I didn't know if he was having a bad day or what, but he ended up telling me after he was all disheveled, he's like, these are the strangest results. I've never seen anything like this. And he went straight into, where did you grow up? That was his first question. And when I said Hanford, or I said Richland, Washington, and he immediately just goes, Hanford? I was like, yeah. He goes, I did my dissertation on Hanford. And then he just goes into this super odd spiel to me and my wife at the time about how if I was exposed to some sort of radiation, because he'd asked me if I swam in the Columbia River, I'm like, yeah, sure. I mean, I water skied and snorkeled and everything. I grew up on the water. He went into this whole spiel of how he's going to get me, potentially the only solution was to get me into this radiation treatment. It sounded like almost a CAT scan, this special machine that they had. And then he just reinforced that it was going to cost like $100,000 and insurance wasn't going to cover it. And we had to make a decision. And I was so like depressed at this point and everything and this news and his just kind of the weird interaction with him. I just wanted nothing to do with it. And I kind of got out of there. Nothing ever came out of it. But I thought that that was just strange that I'm put in front of a guy that wrote his dissertation on Hanford. And then he's getting these supposed results that are off the charts after like 30 years of practicing as an internist. It was just, you know, we had talked earlier. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. It just seems weird that Hanford kind of played into this and, you know, radiation and the fact that these things are over nuclear power plants as far as sightings.
Yeah. Did you ever check out the dissertation? Because I feel like those are public. Not that I really understand how scholarship works, but I think those are public. Did you check it out or did you ask more questions about what he found in his dissertation?
No, I didn't. And it's, I think it was something at that point in time, I was like, I don't want anything to do with this. I don't know what's going on with me. I was trying to figure out because of all the depression that had come on, that was kind of part of the story where it was a depression I could not explain. It was I explain it like the darkness was in my bones. And you're so frustrated because for somebody that doesn't have a religious background or any spirituality or any knowledge at all, like biblically, it's kind of like, you know, Book of Hosea, lack of knowledge that kills my people. I'm just thinking the typical, oh, it's a chemical imbalance. There's something going on with me psychologically. And, you know, people were saying, well, maybe you need to go to a therapist and get on like some antidepressants. And I told myself, like, I don't even know why, but my whole upbringing and into adulthood, I was like, I will never take antidepressants. I'll fight through it. There's got to be another reason for it. So I just basically didn't want anything to do with it. I dropped it and just never even thought about it again until after I started experiencing the UFOs and things. That's when I was like, when my buddy had mentioned something about Hanford, kind of a switch went off. I'm like, man, that is kind of weird that I had that interaction with that doctor and the results being off the charts, in his words.
I would be curious if we could find it, what he found, but I guess we're not going to know today, so it's going to have to wait for another day.
Maybe I don't want to know.
You mentioned spirituality, and I want to go back there, actually. So let's go back in time to when you were younger, because that's where we started, and I want to build the story from there. You said that your parents never pushed religion or spirituality on you because they wanted you and your brother to make up your own mind. So starting at a young age, what did you personally believe?
You know, I never really thought about it. That's the thing. I think I was kind of a deep thinker as a kid. So I would think about things, but I didn't think a lot about God, the afterlife. I would kind of think of, I guess, more material, scientific. Maybe that's just, you know, elementary school. We still were in that kind of scientific-based society. We did a lot of experiments and things, it seemed like, more than most elementary kids, at least. So I was a deep thinker on that realm, the material realm, but I just never stopped until this stuff started happening, and I thought, well, there's got to be something else I'm not understanding. So it was, and my parents, I think, were at this point, the good thing about this is kind of the beautiful thing about this story. You know, you go through a lot of pain and there's always a purpose in it. And I could see, of course, now that I've gotten to know God through this whole thing, is you see that all of this pain that people that I was more concerned with the people around me that had to go through seeing like their dad, their son, their husband go through this deep, deep darkness I couldn't explain. and then just kind of go off the rails with everything that happened. And I know my mom for a fact, she went through this whole thing with me, and she knew, she believed, she knew this stuff was going on. And I think that that definitely brought her to God. I know it did, because we have conversations about it, and she's in prayer and everything else, reads scripture. So that's awesome. I mean, if this pain was for that to happen, maybe that was the purpose, you know, just for maybe one or two people to figure out that, hey, this guy's struggle was something he couldn't explain. Maybe we need to examine what's going on in the unseen and what we don't understand.
So just to reiterate, you didn't really have a belief system. That's what it sounds like. You didn't think about it. You didn't really have one. You were just going along with the crowd, I'm guessing. Is that right?
Yeah, but it did change when I got into, I remember sophomore year of college. So I was at junior college, and I had made like a decision to myself that I would created my identity essentially. And my identity was pretty simple. It was basically treat other people the way you want to be treated, work hard, play hard, and make people laugh. And that was kind of my motto, because I wanted to make people feel good. I think I didn't have depression as I was younger, but maybe a sliver of darkness that making other people laugh made me feel better. But that was simple. It was like work hard, play hard, treat other people the way you want to be treated, make other people laugh. And beyond that, I didn't think much about it. And that's why, you know, as we go into the story, and depending on the questions you have, is the moving with that philosophy into like the corporate world and things, that just kind of continued, where there was really only one time before, you know, during college, that I had kind of a little whisper that said, hey, God's trying to talk to you. And I kind of ignored it. And yeah, we can get into that. That was during baseball at University of Arizona after junior college.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because you talked about play hard, and I think the audience probably don't know, but I understand what you're talking about, because you were a baseball player, a high-level baseball player. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about your career, because that's actually an interesting part of your life, and then you can tie that in with the story that you were just talking about.
Yeah, so when I'd gone off to college, and the reason I tell this story is, you know, not to brag, I always try to tell people, hey, this was just kind of the typical American dream, or at least on paper, that's what it looked like, right? So I get to junior college, I'm drafted by Major League Baseball freshman year. I was kind of a late bloomer, so I didn't sign. I ended up going to the University of Arizona, which is a great four-year. And at the U of A, this is where we had a coach that was, he was Christian, and he's a Hall of Fame coach. He's since passed, but he was kind of a legend in the baseball community. And I remember him calling me into the office. And when I say work hard, play hard, it was like work hard in school, you know, work hard at whatever jobs I have. But then play hard, it's like, I'm going out and I'm going to party, right? That was the deal. I'll go out and party, and I'll use kind of a reward system. So when I'm done at the end of the week working hard, then I'll go out on the weekends and have fun. That's kind of where the work hard, play hard aspect of it. And I took that into like U of A, and in the baseball program, you know, when you're a JC transfer, you are already, you know, 20, 21 years old. And when you have freshmen coming in that are like barely turning 18 years old, and some of these guys are, you know, some of the best players in the nation, well, I shouldn't have been so foolish, really, when I look back, because really what I did is I was, in a way, ringleading some of the freshmen, because they looked up to me, and I took the party in, you know, outside of baseball on the weekends. And when, you know, they're looking up to that, and it's like, it's just not a good example. And my coach, he's getting whiff of this, and he calls me in the office, and he's like, hey, Jason, you're basically ringleading these freshmen. I don't like it, you know, so I got a stern talking to. But at the same time, I got a sense that he was looking out for me, because he did mention at the end of the meeting, he goes, you know, he goes, you've been given a God-given gift to throw a baseball as a left-hander in the 90-mile-an-hour range, and you're throwing it all away at the rate you're going. And he goes, speaking of God, he goes, why don't you get to some Fellowship of Christian Athletes meetings and get on the right track? Because he had headed up some of those meetings and things. And that's where you kind of go, you know what? I knew at the time, I'm like, maybe I'm supposed to be listening to something here. But typical 21-year-old, I kind of just ignored it and just kept on going with the same ideology from there. After U of A, I got picked up in by the Rockies and played in Portland, Oregon. Was up there for just a summer, so a short-lived, but, you know, still living my dream, drafted by baseball, get an opportunity to play. It was just kind of living the same philosophy, you know, work hard, play hard, you go out. I was a closer, so you go out and you're pitching once every, you know, maybe once every game, but you're throwing an inning. And then after that, you're going out at the end of the game, and we're doing what guys at that age do, 18 to 22 years old in the minor leagues, and going out having fun, coming back and doing it all over again. So that was kind of the gist of my whole ideology until getting off to into the corporate world after that.
Yeah, let's talk about the corporate world. Like, what did you go after the baseball career? I've been there, you know, training to be a professional athlete, and not everyone, I would say, I would fit in that category, necessarily has a plan of like what happens if it doesn't work out. I don't know if you did, but what did you do after the baseball dream was over?
Yeah, there was no plan, right? You get done and you're relieved. You're thinking, first of all, I'll make it to the big leagues, right? But at some point you realize these guys you're playing with are the cream of the crop, physical specimens. And if you're a later round pick, and especially a sport like baseball, you're probably not going to get a shot unless you're just an all-star in the minor league. So there wasn't much of a plan. So I ended up just one of those things kind of falls in your lap. I ended up dating who ended up becoming my wife for 18 years. And she was an international business major. So she started in finance at a large firm. And I had 1 year left of college to finish up after pro ball. So I finished that up and then ended up going to work at this finance firm, which I was surprised I could even get a job there because I was a communications major, didn't have any finance background, but it was the dot-com bubble, which if you don't remember the dot-com bubble is when all the tech stocks were just going crazy during like 98, 99, then 2000, 2001, they just came to an end. But I started at this company. And then the same thing, you know, it was almost like when I look back on life, it was almost like a setup for failure in a way, in a humorous way, I guess, because it seemed like from day one, even through grade school, all the way through into career, it was like, and I didn't like it, which is a weird thing. The awards, I could not stand getting awards. I didn't like the recognition. But since like first grade on, it would be like, oh, you got a Young Authors Award 2 years in a row. And then now you have the Presidential Fitness Award for an athlete. And now you have this award. Now you're homecoming king. And I could not stand all that attention. I didn't like the whole accolade thing. But it seems to what happens, at least for me, is it starts becoming part of your identity, right? You're like, oh, I got to strive. I got to keep up this reputation. And I know a lot of people get caught up in that. Even though I did not like it, didn't matter. This was part of my identity as I got older. And then you feel like you're just kind of playing the game. You're in the program. And you start feeling like, well, I'm sucked into the golden handcuffs now. But I worked my way up very quick in finance, even though I didn't have a background in it. Same thing, just put my head to the grindstone, just went at it and ended up being a public speaker for this large corporation, which was great. I think I was kind of, you know, built to do that, not thinking that I would ever be a public speaker, but they wanted me to go out and start teaching strategies and economics and market commentary. So I got promoted out to Los Angeles from Scottsdale, Arizona, and literally did that for the next 15 years. And that was a lot of, you know, you had heard, you know, when I shared on the last podcast for the first time, that was where there was a lot of alone time because you're on the road, stop and start in hotels and traveling around. And the reason I bring that up is sometimes I wonder if that's kind of a part of where you may become a potential target is when you're alone a lot, because it's like, you know, kind of like that sheep that's wandering, you know, away from the flock, and it's like the lion's ready to prowl. So it's, I don't know if that was part of it, but that was essentially corporate life. Is my life just continued on as far as, you know, work hard, play hard, get it done. That was my mentality.
All right. So let's get to the beginning of your UFO encounters. Can you kind of explain what your life looked like at that point? And then even like before the first encounter happened, what did your life look like? And was there anything strange that happened in the leading up months, or I don't know if it was years, months, weeks before the first encounter?
Yeah, it was about 3 years. And this started in like 2014, went through 15, 16. And then this is when I knew something was off. The strange thing about this, Gabriel, is when I look back on it, is I had this kind of thought in the back of my head for almost a decade before all of these encounters happened. The actual first manifestation encounter of the light and everything happened in 2018. But there was a period leading up to at least a decade where I would feel like I couldn't celebrate anything for very long because there was always something in the back of my head going, well, enjoy it now because this is not going to last. Something bad is going to happen. And I didn't understand that. I almost built kind of a guilt conscience over it because I'm thinking, why would somebody think that way? Why would, you know, that is there something going on with me psychologically? So I didn't know how to handle that. And I didn't understand what it was. But the darkness, when I say darkness, was that depression that came on like 14, 15, and 16. That's what led into before I actually had the experience in 2018. Now, with that said, I always want to bring this up to people because this can be part of it, is I'd always been someone that drank, you know, and especially towards the end when I was starting to get depressed, I would start drinking more and more wine at night, just trying to kind of mask it, which is totally counterintuitive because you don't get good sleep and you're just going to be more tired the next day. But I was very functional. I could get up in the morning, get to the gym, get to work. So it didn't really affect my life in too many ways, at least. Eventually, it started creeping in that direction and I could feel it. But this is where I was getting the sleep paralysis, which I know that there's people listening to this that had experienced that. I never had heard of sleep paralysis before, so I didn't understand what was going on. If you've never experienced it before, at least for me, what it was is you are in a state where I wouldn't even remember the nightmares most of the time. I just knew that they were super, super intense, super scary, like something was trying to intimidate me. And then when the vision or the dream would come to an end, it's like you're conscious laying there in bed, knowing what's going on, and you're trying to scream, but nothing will come out. So you're like in the strange thing about these occurrences with me is they were physical pain. I was having physical pain all up and down my body, especially like my abdomen, almost like your organs are absolutely tensing up. So I thought I was getting sick. I'm like, I'm getting cancer or something. This doesn't make any sense. And I would come to, and it would always just be kind of like you're screaming in your dream, but nothing really comes out. And I bring that up because I've then came to learn later on that yes, that like sleep paralysis is a part of what these people that have UFO experiences encounter as well, is the sleep paralysis phenomenon, which I don't even call it a phenomenon. It's a real thing. I know tons of people that have suffered from sleep paralysis all the way up to they've experienced like a choking or something by an entity or, you know, all sorts of weird things that I never thought of because I didn't have that background, that I didn't believe in any of this stuff. I literally thought that the devil was an excuse for people to not have to take accountability. That's the bottom line. That's the way I looked at it.
A lot of people that look at it this way, and I see that in the comments of my videos a good amount. But let's get actually to your first encounter, the first UFO encounter that you had. Can you explain to us kind of maybe how the day went, and if you can explain in detail what that was like, because it's not an experience that a lot of people have. So I'm sure that people are going to be curious about it.